serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the chance to meet an amazing 98-year-old survivor of the Battle of the Bulge. John Parker served with the 84th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II. On the wall of his home in Merced, California, you'll find the Bronze Star Medal, accompanied by the citation that describes what he did to earn it. And with John's permission, I'm going to read that to you. So this is from the office of the commanding general of the 84th Infantry Division, the Rail Splitters, Sergeant John M. Parker, 333rd Infantry, United States Army, for heroic service in connection with military operations against the enemy in Belgium, 15-16 January 1945. Although exhausted from a previous patrol during which he had gained accurate and vital information concerning the enemy, Sergeant Parker guided another patrol to the enemy positions. Encountering heavy enemy fire, Sergeant Parker, without regard for his own safety, routed the enemy from their foremost position and captured two prisoners. Shortly thereafter, Sergeant Parker captured three additional Germans. The courage, initiative, and aggressiveness displayed by Sergeant Parker contributed much to the success of his company's operations and are in accordance with the finest traditions of the military service. So that's what the general said about it. I want to hear it in your version.
We had received information that there were somebody out there, and so the lieutenant in the platoon designated the three of us, the staff sergeant, myself, and another fella, and we went out on patrol, and we had a firefight with them. There were two that we encountered, and we got in a firefight with them. They were both wounded. I don't think any of our patrol was wounded at all. One was severely wounded. Then one we took back, practically carried him back because he was a source of information, and they wanted to interview him, talk to him. But the other one was not. He didn't make it, but we did save one.
And that was the first patrol or the second?
That was the second patrol.
But you had gone out the night before, and the citation describes you as being exhausted from that. Can you put into words how exhausted or what that's like? I mean, Did you get any rest?
Of course, you don't get much rest anyway. When you're out on the line, you know, you're in foxholes, and you don't get a lot of rest. And so then you'd been out in your tents because you're out on patrol. That's what he's referring to, that we were mentally strained and also physically tired.
So then they asked you to go back out, or you volunteered to go back out?
They asked us to go back out. Not supposed to volunteer.
I've heard a lot of guys say that, never volunteer for anything in the Army. That's the first rule. So when they say, we want you to go back there and take us to where you were, is there part of you that doesn't want to do that?
Not really, but you do what they say.
And how many guys were with you?
There was only three of us.
So there's three of you, and it says that you led them back to that enemy position, and you routed the enemy, and then you captured two prisoners, and then you captured three more. So it sounds like they had you outnumbered.
Well, they did. But I don't know why that happened, but it did. It was hard. And I don't think we didn't get wounded at all. But we had fired at these two in the second patrol and wounded both of those.
Were you firing at some others, too, that were in the area that probably ran away? Or?
Well, no. I don't know why. There was only two people there. Maybe they had had a firefight someplace else.
Well, and then it says that on the way back you encountered three more? And they just surrendered to you, or what?
No, I don't understand that whole thing there. But when we got the two, the other ones, that had happened before that. But then when the last two we had, and we had a firefight with them, and then we brought one of them back.
And that sure sounds like a situation where it was going to either be you or them.
Yeah, it would. You're out in the woods, middle of the woods, nobody's around. Whoever gets the fire done right wins, and that's what happened.
Is there a weight, is there an emotional or mental weight that comes along with that situation when you realize that the bullets you guys were firing claimed the life of an enemy?
It was. And you always think about when didn't make it. You always wonder about him. He's somebody else, you know, fighting a war, has a family. You think about those things.
Date-wise, mid-January, that must have been toward the tail end of the Battle of the Bulge, huh?
Yeah, it was. The 84th Infantry Division had been transferred south to the Battle of the Bulge. And then when the Battle of the Bulge was over, then we were transferred back to the northern sector up right against the British. The lieutenant in charge of our platoon particularly got the staff sergeant and I and told him that they were having applications for people that wanted to go to OCS in France. And so the staff sergeant and I thought, well, you know, it sounds like a good opportunity. And so we applied and they approved our transfer. And so then we were transferred. It was around Krefeld, Germany is about as far as I got. Oh, and then one thing that during this time that was sort of family, one of my brothers was, he had joined the Army and joined the 9th Army headquarters in Presidio, San Francisco. And in that 9th Army headquarters, they had no units, no divisions or anything, but the 9th Army then was sent overseas. They were in, 9th Army was in charge of the 84th Infantry Division. So a couple of times that when we were off the line and we'd go back for rest and relaxation, I got to go back and see my brother at 9th Army headquarters. And that was good.
What a treat.
Yeah, and to see my brother, yeah.
What
I also saw after the war, my other brother was in Italy. They had compassionate leave, and you could visit family relatives in the area. And so I put in and spent a week with him in Italy. He was in the Air Corps at that time.
When you're that far away from home and you see a familiar face like that, how do you guys spend your time? What kind of stuff do you talk about?
Oh, talk about our experiences and what they've been doing and what's happened at home and that sort of thing. Really good to have the feeling again, back with my family again.
Timeline-wise, when was it that they sent you to France for OCS?
No, I don't remember. I think it was a six-week course. We were almost through about 2 weeks after the war that we finished school. We graduated and were commissioned.
So VE Day happened 2 weeks before you got your commission. So you must have left your unit somewhere around early April or something like that, which is right before your unit liberated a couple concentration camps. I'm sure there are other combat situations. Do you ever wonder if heading off to OCS could have saved your life?
I thought about that, yeah. And it's always part of our thinking at the time. You know, if you want to go to school, get out of combat, and decided, yeah, that's a good idea. So that sergeant and I decided that's what we wanted to do. So we did.
So when that news comes that Germany has surrendered, you're in France in school, and I imagine that was some pretty welcome news.
Oh, it was real welcome. But then everybody said, well, where are we going now? And big talk about Japan, you know, the East, and probably that's where we would be going.
Yeah, now you're going to be an officer, so you're going to have a lot of responsibility and other lives in your care, you're probably thinking.
Oh, yeah, it'd be a platoon leader, probably. It was an infantry, and I'm sure it would be the infantry.
And I don't want to get it wrong, you tell me, but it sounds like if those bombs hadn't have been dropped, you might have been leading an infantry platoon into Japan.
Oh, sure. I'm sure that's where we would, because they would, we're going to need plenty of people if they're going to invade Japan. I ended up in what was called, that was their name, 1313th Labor Supervision Company in Mannheim, Germany. Mannheim was nothing but rubble. This was really a POW. They were prisoners of war in this camp. They called it labor supervision because all those POWs were sent out every day working in Mannheim to clean up all the debris and trying to begin the reconstruction of the whole town. And there was, I think, around 400 people that lived there. They were prisoners. And they had officers, German officers. We worked with the German officers most of the time. But we were probably five people in charge of that unit. We had our own quarters and had a German woman they furnished the food, and she did the cleaning and cooking for our unit.
How long were you there?
9 or 10 months. And I'd have enough points to go home. That was another thing, that as a sergeant, I would have had enough points to go home. But when I became an officer, I'd have enough points to go home.
I was just thinking that as you were saying that. Here you've got the Bronze Star, which is extra points. You've been over there all this time. If you had ridden it out, you could have gone home and seen your wife. But who knows if you would have survived.
Oh, yeah.
So you go to OCS, but now you're stuck there for almost another year?
Yeah, there. And yeah, I was there for about a year. Then I started the process of going home. This was in 46. And of course, my wife, she was very disappointed that I didn't get to come home in 45.
Everybody else is coming home.
Everybody's going home, you know. Oh, yeah. Well, why can't you go home? Well, I don't have enough points.
But that duty for 9 or 10 months, as you said, supervising some of the guys that you used to be fighting, some of the guys could have been the guys shooting at you. That's and right. Killing your friends. Did you get a different perspective about the German people, or at least the German military, from working with those prisoners?
Well, not we really didn't have much contact with them. Of course, I didn't speak German. Anyway, we dealt mostly with the office, their own officers there. And I think a lot of them could have gone home, but a lot of them didn't have homes to go to, didn't know where homes were. They lost their family and the conflict and everything. So you think about them a lot and what they're going through. They're sort of glad the war is over, I think.
Well, and that is a major distinction that I think a lot of times we don't consider, because we think about all the American servicemen coming home. If they were fortunate enough to come home, they did have a home to come home to, where the people on the other side largely didn't. When you finally did get to come home and see your wife again, 3 years later, more than 3 years after you guys got married, what was that like?
Oh, that was great, yeah. I was discharged in Camp Beale in Northern California, and she was there, and that was great. You know, you dream about that and think about going home all the time. And when it happens, it's a great feeling. You're back home, back to family again.
In all those nights that you were overseas, those nights where you're freezing in a foxhole and shivering and trying to stay dry and not die from the elements, and the tree bursts are going off or the rifle fire's coming in, whatever the things may be. In all that time over there, were there days or nights where you wondered, am I ever going to see Irene again?
Oh, sure. You'll think about that. But that's a fact of life when you're in a situation like that where your life could go at any time. And so you get used to being aware of that, and you learn to live with that. It's not good, but it's there all the time. You always think about that.
And four of you Parker boys went over, and all four came back, huh?
And all four came back, yeah. And I got to see my two brothers over there, got to see Miller twice and Dick down in Italy. He was in Ordnance Air Corps. But I never did get to see Jim until I came home, and he had been discharged too. But all of us came home, and I was the only one in combat. And Miller was, he had a push job. He's in 9th Army headquarters. And Dick did too. He was in charge of a depot for bombs and ordnance.
Is that something that you talked about when you got back? Or is that something that you just kind of filed away because you were so happy to be back with Irene and ready to actually have a life?
We talked it over, my brothers and I, and we did that overseas. Yeah. When I got to see my brother Miller and Dick down in Italy. But then when we came home, we all, you know, exchanged experiences we had and grateful that all four of us got to come home. I got out in 46, came home in August, and my wife was living in Bakersfield with her family. So we got an apartment, and I enrolled in Fresno State in the GI Bill, and they paid me to finish my last year of college. And so I graduated in 47.
And you became a public accountant and did that for decades, and the farm that your father had started out here in La Grande, California, is still in the family. And we can go to a farmer's market any weekend and buy some Shasky Farms nuts.
Yeah, that's from the farm my dad bought in 1942. Family again.
Yeah.
They're still living there. We've got one, two, three, four. I guess there's four families living there on the property now.
It's such a small world. One of the guys running that farm used to be my next-door neighbor in Las Banas, and his brother is the one I see selling the nuts at the farmer's market. If you see an upside-down sign, it's a trick. He's trying to get you to come buy his walnuts and almonds there.
That's Tom.
Small world. I've got to ask you, and if there's anything we left out, I hope you'll share anything that's relevant to you. But I've got to ask you about going on the honor flight from here in California all the way to Washington, D.C. to visit that World War II memorial that was paid for by World War II veterans. I mean, it was private money raised to put it there. It's there to honor 406,000 guys who are a lot like you but didn't get to come home. What was that experience like for you?
It was a great experience. And I was amazed at the emotions I felt there at the memorial for World War II. I think the water fountains had a lot to do with that. I couldn't understand why the water, it brought the whole thing to life, is what it did. And it was a great addition, but the memorial was great. Everything's first class. We got to stay in good hotels, good food. We enjoyed that.
Uh-huh. And who went with you?
My grandson. He was good help, and yeah, that was a great experience for him.
You know, I don't think I've ever heard anyone say that the water brought it all together, but that makes sense because that sound is always there, and there's some movement there, and there's some life to it. And it's juxtaposed against that backdrop. If you stand on the right side, you'll see the water in the foreground, and right behind it, those 4,000 gold stars that represent over 400,000 Americans who died. When you looked at that, when you looked at that freedom wall, as they call it there, what went through your mind?
Well, emotional. I guess it was really emotional there. And also at the Vietnam Memorial was very emotional, too. But they were those. You think of all the tragedies and the lives that were lost and interrupted and changed. It was a great experience. But I think the water made a big difference. It brought the whole thing to life.
And it sounds like you added a little water to it.
Yeah, I did. Very emotional.
And I wouldn't be surprised if your grandson did either, because, as you say, those were lives interrupted, but they also represent lives that never occurred. And your grandson wouldn't have been born if you didn't make it home.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Is that something that sinks in? If you look, your two children, your two grandchildren, you ever look at them and say, man, if one of those tree bursts had hit me instead of the guy over there, they wouldn't be here?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, think about that. Yeah, it's at times very emotional. Yeah, you got two grandchildren, and hopefully we'll have great-grandchildren.
Yeah. And you had 70 years of marriage with Irene until you lost her in 2013. Was it hard to get used to being a civilian again after all that time in uniform?
I remember my wife, I didn't have PTSD. I didn't have that. But particularly at sleeping, I would, have nightmares and throw my arms around, and I don't think I ever yelled or anything, but I did. I think a lot of people experience that too. Hard to sleep, you remember things. And even today, loud noises are real sudden loud noises. That really make me, I react to that.
Have you ever found anything that helps with that?
No, not much. Prayer is good. Prayer helps. Yeah, depend on the Lord to help you through those things. Yeah, and he did help me through combat. And that's a hard thing to know, because there are a lot of people who are, believers and so on. But at least he helped you get through that. I would like to say, oh, he saved my life, but why didn't he save everybody's life? Why didn't he save my friend's life? It's one of those things. But the Lord helps you get through those things.
Well, if there's anything else that's important to you, I'm all ears, but I don't want to forget to thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for sharing your story with us. Is there something that you look back on, maybe when you see that bronze star on the wall, or you see the combat infantry badge that's under it, or you look at that familiar axe in the wood of the rail splitters logo? Is there something when you look at those that you feel most proud of or most thankful for?
Proud because I did serve, and honorably served, 3.5 years, apart from family, apart from wife. Just appreciate all that and appreciate the opportunity to serve, even though it was dangerous duty.
And I mentioned when we started that you are still in the same house that you started living in 1949 here in Merced, California. This city's changed a lot over those years, a lot more people here now. But I think one thing that stayed the same is you're flying that flag outside. And I see the stars and stripes when I walk up. Why do you do that? What does that mean to you?
Well, that means a lot to me. It's a family. It's the country that we represent, and it's an honor to fly the flag, an honor to acknowledge the gift that we have here in this country and freedom, great country. And we run into problems now, but I'm sure that some way we'll survive and we'll be greater in the future. I really think we will. People just need to understand that the nation is greater than some of the problems that we are encountering. If we can ever get past the political bickering, almost hatred between the different factions, the two different political parties, I think eventually we will and be a better country for it. But we have to go through what we're going through in order to get there.
Wisdom and perspective from a 98-year-old World War II veteran. That's John Parker of Merced, California. If you want to put a face with that youthful and energetic voice you heard, pull up the photos on Facebook. Just punch in Hometown Heroes Radio or head over to hometownheroesradio.com. And join us again next time when we're reminded once again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.